Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
Representing for a second time, Whip Snakes Lacrosse Club!
Oh! Chase, was that you?
Oh, no.
Uh-oh.
Did you break the trophy?
No.
Yeah, it was, that was pretty crazy.
Scores! What? What?
You got to get the ball to 42.
Run lacrosse!
Hello and welcome back to the PLL Happy Hour podcast alongside Chris Rosenthal. I'm your host, Kevin Brown. And boy, fans, you've missed us the last couple of weeks. We had the season superlatives and quarterfinal preview, and then all of a sudden it's the championship game. All right. So to make up for it, we've got a special podcast for you. Plenty of guests, starting with the one, the only, Joe Keegan. Joe, welcome to the show.
What's up, guys? Appreciate you having me. Fired up to talk Whip Snakes Archers.
The fourth seeded Whip Snakes back in the title game for the fourth time. Defending champion Archers, two seeded Archers, looking to repeat for their second PLL championship. Now, before the second half of the podcast, listeners will be live from Championship Media Day. So it's a new event. Pretty pumped to be live there alongside Rosie and bring you some live interviews with players, coaches, and other guests for some awesome pregame analysis. But before we get into that, this first half of the podcast is to set the stage, to get you caught up on how we got to this point. How did we get here? Well, the Whip Snakes defeated the top-seeded Atlas in one of the most epic semifinals of all time, and the Archers held Chaos to a single goal. 57 seconds left in the game, and Zach Geddes finally did it. What a defensive display. 18 saves from Brett Dobson. We'll get into all that and more, but Rosie, I want to start with you. Have you ever seen a overtime quite as enthralling as the overtime we saw when the Whip Snakes defeated the Atlas?
No, absolutely not. I think when you generally go into an overtime, the expectation is, you know, you're going to see something happen real quick, and that's that. Right. You know, it's this battle back and forth all game long. You know, who's going to come out on top? Who's going to be the strongest team? Who wants it more? And then, you know, it bounces off of somebody's foot on the wing of the face off. And there's a fast break. And that's the game. Right. It seems very easy to score overtime goals sometimes because you just need one team to blink first. But this one, you had teams going back and forth. Another situation where we are really reminded just how glorious it is that the coaches have to stand back and not call timeouts during these overtimes, right? They're standing there. You get the camera shots of the coaches just freaking out. They got to take their hands off the wheels. I mean, what more could you ask? You got a shot ringing off the pipe in overtime, heading the other way, back and forth. Everyone just freaking out. Announcers have to just let go as well. They're just screaming, watching it like everybody else. You basically have the players, and literally anyone else involved has to be a fan at that point, right? It's incredible. What more could you ask?
Kark and Boyle were not the only ones to almost have an aneurysm during that overtime period. We were all on the edge of our seats. It was incredible. Just I had two final score graphics ready to pump out there, and I was like, what is going to happen? Because, like you said, just the trading of stops on either end. Brendan Krebs finishes with 17 saves. And Liam Etzman, I think he finished with 9 saves in this one. Seemed like half of them came up in the overtime period. An overtime for the ages. Levi Anderson with that swim move. He had the swim move for his first goal. Does it again for his third. He had it again in week 4 against the Atlas as well to kind of put that game to bed late. Joe, what were your initial reactions from this one?
Yeah, it was a lot to unpack, right? That was the second longest overtime we've seen in PLL. Like going 7+ minutes deep into overtime with no timeouts is just back and forth. Both teams had their chances. Obviously, Atlas fans going to have nightmares about Jake Stevens ringing the pipe. A couple of blocked shots from Tim Muller. Good looks for really everybody on the Atlas offense there. And then finally, it was really what got the Whipsnakes to overtime. Levi capping that off with that swim move. Maybe the most dangerous move in lacrosse right now. Like from a size standpoint, the Whipsnakes midfield was just too much for the Atlas shorties. Whether it was Heacock dodging through sticks, Levi swimming over guys, Ryan Conrad inverting them when he got the short stick. Those guys have been the difference makers for the Whipsnakes. It's funny to look back on this team in June. We were waiting for Tucker Dordovic to get healthy, hoping Brad Smith would get healthy, looking at that as a weakness on this team, that offensive midfield group. Now it's absolutely a strength. We're probably going to talk at length about how the hell the Archers are going to match up with that group. Who do they pull? I didn't even mention Mike Chanichuk. There's a ton of dudes with unique skill sets. And Levi and the Whips were just too much for the Atlas eventually.
I think you hit the nail on the head in this one, because the names that you just rattled off, right, with Heacock putting in a very important hat trick, Anderson, the rookie, TJ Malone, obviously one of the rookie of the year finalists. He had a team high 4 points and had that sick one hander in that second half coming around that left side of the cage. Now, so I wrote on insidelacrosse.com, you can check it out, Bridging the Eras. I dubbed the article for this Whipsnake season to get back to the championship game. I doubted them all year. At 2-4 especially, I never really thought this was a possibility. But to see the fringe moves that Coach Jim Sagnita has made, combined with how well he drafted, I think they're kind of ahead of schedule with the not rebuilding from bridging the era of the Rambo, Zed Williams dominance in 2019 and 2020 to repeat like that. And back in the 21 title game to now being right back there with all this youth and vets combined. It's a special mix for sure. But with you two guys, I think you're in prime company to answer this next question, because you're able to bridge the eras for the MLL and PLL. See what I did there? Nice transition. The excitement that this semifinal had. Has there, what other semifinals would you kind of be able to put in this tier of epicness?
Well, I want to, first I'll say this. I don't think this is an exaggeration. And I don't think this is like hyperbole. I legitimately feel like every year of professional lacrosse is bigger than the last one. As far as, you know, the epic scale or any sort of, you know, metric or kind of vibe centric metric you want to give it. There's just more eyes. Social media is more active. It's so much more difficult to miss what's going on with, you know, this league or, you know, whatever league it may have been in the past. It just gets so much easier to follow these things. And plus, like I said, there's just more people watching. So, you know, if a story was a scale of 1 to 10, it was like a 5 level exciting back in 2006. That's a pretty tiny amount of people. We get that same level of exciting now. You're going to get exponentially more, right? Conversations, podcasts, you name it. There's just so much more going on surrounding these events. So I legitimately feel like this next one will be even bigger than the one that came before it. That being said, you know, when I think semifinals, do you think the Cannons, Lizards, from, was that 2015? I believe it was when we established that's when that took place. You know, you look back on that team, on both of those teams, and the rosters really stood the test of time. You know, it wasn't just a group of guys who were all kind of, you know, coming into their own at the right time, or some, you know, scrappy guys who knew their roles and pieced it all together. It was just kind of stacked legends on both sides of the ball. And it was one of those games where the outcome, it kind of justified the anticipation. Everything you expected it to be, it did end up happening. And it makes perfect sense when you look at some of those All-Stars on those teams.
No, absolutely. The game was... Just that overtime alone was super memorable with that final sequence with Gittleman taking that shot, going in transition from that Ratliff pass, and rest is history with Rabel finding Matt Gibson for the open netter dunk. This one, I'm glad we didn't get, although that back and forth transition play was so exciting, I'm glad we got like a very nice lacrosse move of a, though there were some controversy in the Instagram comments. Was it a ward? Was it not? It was never going to be called there. To swim move Peyton Rzonka that, or no, it was Chuck Amizio, excuse me, Peyton, that cleanly, and give Liam Entman the eyes. That leaner. Oh my goodness. Whew. It's.
Joe, your thoughts on that? Swim move wards. Is that a kind of thing? Is there ever a place for calling a ward on a swim move?
Not in my opinion. The short six in this league get away with a ton of physicality. In my opinion, a move like that by Levi is just the offensive equivalent of what the short six are able to do. I think it makes it more fun to watch when they're playing that way. It gives the short sticks a better chance on defense. You see a lot of these short sticks, you know, some of the ones that we'll preview coming up in this championship game, really not just like holding their own in their matchup, but dictating their matchup. So I'm all for the equal but opposite force applied from either side. I think that's all good in my book.
A brilliant equation by all accounts in my mind. Now, when you talk about a semifinal that was this epic, it's hard not to experience the come down and the collective breath of relief that I think all lacrosse fans had watching this second semifinal of just how dominant the Archers were defensively, holding the Carolina Chaos to just one goal was phenomenal, but for that to be in the last minute of the game, to me, this was Ament asserting himself early with those first three of the first four goals. And I think Dyson Williams really just had that sick BTB to start off. And coming off a game where they're like so dominant against Boston defensively, to see that first goal go in, I think, was huge. And to see it go in with that much style was just another thing. You saw the Ament backhander. They were feeling themselves early. Definitely took the foot off the gas in the second half. And I think Chaos really rushed things earlier than they should have. Like, a 9-goal deficit is hard to come back from. So, obviously, you're going to hunt some twos and some transition goals, and the D mids and poles wanted to help out, right? You see your offense struggling and you want to help out. Just wasn't meant to be for the offense, but Rosie, what did you see from Brett Dobson and this Archers defense that makes you to believe they're the team that can be the second to repeat in the PLL era?
Well, I would say the one play defensively that really stood out to me in this game, you had Josh Byrne trying to get a one-on-one against Graham Hossack. And when he rolls back, as we've seen him do to great success thousands of times, you have Mason Woodward, I believe it was Mason Woodward, sneaking up behind him. And as soon as he kind of gets that blind side, goes and checks and completely de-sticks him, right? Now, that just kind of encompassed everything that the Archers, in my opinion, look to accomplish defensively and do so well. You know, you have to have that timing down. We see so many times in this league you know, somebody kind of gets left one-on-one and you're essentially just kind of screwed. You know what I mean? The offensive talent is so high that if they can get just a simple step back, you know, we've seen somebody like Matt Rambo do it 1,000 times. It's not even so much about dodging. It's just getting your hands free when you're that talented. But in a situation like that, if you can hold a one-on-one matchup and then at the very last second make it a two-on-one matchup, when, you know, the offensive threat isn't quite expecting it, just nothing but success. And I think that is, you know, like I said, something the Archers are really trying to accomplish and something they're doing especially well. Warren Jeffrey has gotten some credit for that. I don't think he's gotten enough, and that's on me. I plan to write more good stuff about Warren Jeffrey coming up very soon. But just the being the second person there without, you know, without leaving the slide too open, without presenting the rest of your defense in a way that really leaves them hanging, is something they're very good at doing. And it's kind of a split second decision, but they've got to be able to do it right away. And they have done a fantastic job at it so far.
Joe, could Brett Dobson have been any more unflappable than he was on Saturday night?
That's the word. That's Bates's word, right? Unflappable. No, that was the unflappablest performance you're going to get. I mean, a shutout would have been crazy. We've never even seen a team allow 2 goals in pro lacrosse history. 3 was the record, and it's only been done 6 times since 2001. So to allow 1 goal, allow it on a playoff stage, that was the most dominant defensive performance I've seen. Credit to Dobbs in between the pipes, Tony Rush putting together another masterful game plan, and like Rosie said, like just timely help by all these guys down low who have really gelled with 2 new faces in the lineup, right? Like this isn't the exact, if you're looking at where there's been turnover from last year's championship team, there's been more on the defensive end, right? With Bo Peterson slid into the lineup and Mason Woodward down low. And now Kobe Barrs in for Cam Wires last weekend. There are a lot of young faces on that defense and they really haven't missed a beat. They've been playing at a championship level all summer. So credit to Coach Rush for getting them on the same page and Dobson for making all those stops.
The Archers have this ability, really more than anyone else in the league, it feels like, to just call up any one of their 25 men and be like, hey, man, you're in the lineup, and they're going to do a fantastic job. We saw with Barrs in the semifinals, Jack Van Overbeek in the last weekend of the regular season, Reed Bowering in last year's title game, just 1 through 25, these guys are ready. And Rosie, you wrote it in the rundown. I'm going to throw the question right back at you, but both of you, really. Are you surprised that they're doing this without Tom Schreiber, the reigning MVP?
Yeah, I mean, I have to give them a great deal of credit. I thought there was going to be a significant period of time where they couldn't quite figure out what to do with those touches and what to do with the offensive responsibility. You know, obviously the surrounding talent is really, really high, right? You know, like Grant Amon is still super good. Connor Fields, Mac O'Keefe, all extremely high level talented players. But you lose somebody like Tom Schreiber, who is a just expert distributor, right? Who gets everybody, whenever somebody's open, he's going to find them. You know, he's going to keep that offense moving. And if they're not open, he is himself a legitimate threat. You know, like he can take care of the game himself or make everybody around him better. So I thought there were going to be probably a couple weeks where they're trying to figure out, you know, you kind of, where do I toe that line between doing a little bit more and not doing too much? You know, I don't want to run into triple team, but I also, maybe I have to be the guy now that Tom's out. You know, like everybody has their own little identity crisis once somebody like Tom Schreiber leaves. But the transition was so swift, and there was no real legitimate drop-off for any sustained period of time. I think there were probably some kind of external factors to it. Like, it probably, I would say it kind of helped maybe that the whole incident took place in Utah, right? Like, they have that support, and so many of their coaches and players talked about how much support the Utah crowd provided them. Because, you know, that could have been a real low moment for them. You know, you lose your guy. This is, you know, Western Conference title on the line. It would have been very easy to kind of buckle under that pressure right there. But I think it helped having that much support, having, you know, Tom Schreiber back there, having everybody else kind of saying, you know, okay, we're going to win for Tom. We're going to do it for Tom. And also to win like Tom, as they all also emulated, right? They were saying, we need to be like he is, not just talent, but, you know, supporting each other, you know, all these positive characteristics that they all kind of acknowledged and recognized about Tom Schreiber, which, by the way, was really cool that they were able to do it while he was like around and able to hear them say those nice things about him, you know, like giving him his flowers. He'll be back next year, right? You know, he's still around. So it's very cool that they were able to say how much he means to them on and off the field and all that stuff. And I think it did, in fact, help them. Despite all of that, I thought there'd be a little bit of a drop off while they figured things off, but I was wrong.
Yeah, Joe, you think it's fair to say that this Archers club is probably the most well-equipped to deal with an injury to their reigning MVP with the depth that Chris Bates has cultivated?
Well, they've done it. And hypothetically, like if you went down the list, I've seen Chaos play well without Blaze. Austin Kout's done a great job in cage, but could they make a championship run without Blaze? Like, I wouldn't count on it. You look at every other team's MVP like that, like, you know, what do these teams look without their best player? I wouldn't expect any of them to make the championship. I didn't expect the Archers to make it when Tom went down. And that's a credit to the guys, you know, the guys who were sitting on the 25-man roster who suited up and stepped up. But it's also a credit to the superstars, right? Like, it's easier to be a role player when Grant is being Grant or when Dobson is being Dobson, right? And right now, Grant Amen's playing at an elite level. I think that I see the word underrated thrown around a lot. It's kind of just a thing that we say when we don't really know how to describe how well a guy is playing. We just say a guy is underrated, but like, I would say that the guys near the top of the roster are probably the guys that we underrate the most, right? Like we do not differentiate an all pro from an all-star enough. They're not the same thing. An all pro is different. An all pro can win you that trophy on Sunday, and Grant Amen is playing like an all pro.
Yeah, no, I think you get an exception for the underrated usage there, because I think that's a really cool point. Point I was about to make, the fact that they have Matt Moore, Trey LeClair, Grant Amen, all these powerful righties, of course, Schreiber's super left-handed, and I want to get into the matchups here too. It is really a stark difference between Schreiber's ability and those kind of guys, but seeing Amen step up to the task and play his best ball when it matters and when they need him most comes down to Schreiber and Ryan Ambler's leadership, but also Amen being healthy finally. It dealt with a lot of hamstring issues the last couple seasons. So, boys, this is the matchup. Archers versus Whipsnakes. What are some things we're looking out for here in this one? I think they, going back here, live pod, I'll edit this out, week, when did they play? It was like 16-9, right? 16-11. All right. Back in week 5, the Archers defeated the Whipsnakes 16-11. In the Boston Cannons homecoming. The first thing that stuck out to me in this one, and then I'll hand it over to you guys for some initial thoughts, was the amount of times that Mac O'Keefe shot through someone while dodging was just insane. Like, I don't think you can count on that for a second game. But him being able to, when the play was breaking down or in early offense, just shoot it right through someone, sweeping across or calling his own number was crazy. And just with O'Keefe doing that and all the other options they have, just how do you stop these guys? So, Rosie, what's a matchup that you're looking forward to come Sunday?
Well, before I say that, let me tell you one thing that stood out to me in that last matchup. Since we were just talking Tom Schreiber, 5 shots and only 1 assist. Like, obviously Tom Schreiber is excellent, but those are replaceable numbers. You know, that's not like fall apart, what do we do numbers, you know? That being said,
well, I would say before you get into your matchup, because I think that's really emblematic of the whole Utah weekend. And I think Schreiber was turning it on before then, but so they went 8-2 last year, 6-4 this year, a lot more ups and downs, target on their backs, what have you. But Coach Bates said it post-game Saturday night, like, they were focused on peaking at the right time, peaking in September, and I think they definitely did that, accomplished that during their homecoming weekend, which happened to be the last weekend of the regular season. And it's not necessarily Schreiber who did that, obviously, with his injury occurring in that first game. But it is cool that you pointed it out. Like, they can win kind of handily without Schreiber really asserting himself.
Yeah, I would say as far as matchups go, pretty much any time I'm looking at a Whipsnakes game matchup, I am looking to see what the opposing midfielders are doing to them. Because generally when you watch these games, you watch, you know, whoever they're going against just constantly attacking their short sticks. It is, I mean, I don't think I'm revealing any sort of deep scouting report that only I noticed or anything like that. Everybody loves attacking Maryland short sticks. And, you know, if you got to do a two-man game from X, if you got to have, you know, isolate them down the alley, whatever the case may be, people love to pick on them. And so the first thing that comes to mind when I see the last matchup was Trey LeClaire, 2 goals and a 2-pointer. He is ridiculously, uniquely dangerous out the box. I don't know if it is how good Utah is at proper substitutions, or if it is just kind of, maybe he has kind of a freakish ability to get a full head of steam quicker than most. But he really kind of tips the scale into a sort of unbalanced favor as soon as he steps on the field. He really just bursts in front of anybody else. And so there are so many times where it's almost like watching a box game, you know, it's the substitutions give him an extra 20 feet in front of anybody else. And so they just kind of toss it up to him. And all of a sudden it's like you're playing man down and you didn't even realize it. So unless they have a pull waiting for him coming out of the box, which is always kind of sketchy if you have Grant Ament hanging out there anyway, you have a situation where Maryland might be tasked with trying to, you know, chase down or keep up with the Trey LeClaire running at full sprint. So good luck with that.
Yeah, it was interesting the move that they made going into the semifinals. They switched out Jack Corris for Wheaton Jackaboys in that rope unit. It'll be interesting. Pick your poison with that Archers offense. So, Keegs, what about you?
Yeah, there's no easy way to match up with Ament and LeClaire. We haven't seen this Whipsnakes team double pole much. When they did in the past, historically, Bryce Young was that second pole that they bump up. I don't know that typically the Whipsnakes are not a team you're going to see just try something new on the biggest stage of the year. So I don't know if we can expect someone like Ajax to bump up so that they can double pole Ament and LeClaire. But I do think that what their short sticks are equipped for is defending size. They have physical D middies. So I think they, as long as they're on the field when Trey LeClaire's subbing on, they can defend. And they've done a much better job of that later in the year, of forcing teams to beat them 6-on-6 than allowing those transition slow break goals like they were before the All-Star break.
That's a good point, because you put a short stick on O'Keefe, to my earlier point. He starts going off, dodging on you. And it's like, oh my goodness, how am I going to stop this team? But if that's it, like, if, because you saw against the Outlaws, sliding to their midfielders, sliding to the Atlas midfielders, and really staying home on those close defensive matchups, it's worked out for him, and it's paid off with a couple comeback, one goal playoff wins. What about on the other end? Any Whip Snakes versus Archers defense matchups that we're looking forward to?
So, you know, I'm going to have to see. I'm very curious as far as, because, you know, you have kind of your strength versus your size matchups, but you also have a TJ Malone who has an entire season at this point. And if you've been watching him, you notice, wow, okay, so he didn't drop off, right? Like, this wasn't a, you know, get hot for a few weeks and maybe the league starts to catch up. Maybe he starts to burn out or something like that. We've seen nothing of the sort. So I am curious as far as what Coach Resch has in mind as far as kind of deploying Graham Hossack on that matchup. Do you want him to go with, say, a Zed Williams, who may be the more the larger, more intimidating physical presence, but isn't going to have, you know, probably half as many touches? Or, you know, where exactly are you going to want to put him? Are you concerned about Matt Rambo in this game, or is he the third most concerning attackman at this point heading into the matchup? I mean, as far as what my curiosity goes, Whipsnakes, Archers, Whipsnakes on the offense, it's really just how they're going to deploy those defensemen.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I'm excited to get to part two of this podcast soon enough, listener. So hold your horses here. But I'm excited to ask if we get defensive coordinator Tony Resch, the legend who coached Rambo in high school at LaSalle. Like, getting Warren Jeffrey with Graham Hossack was a total, like, part of that era where every defense was game planning against Zed and Rambo. Now that there's this star rookie that's, like, better than both of them, can your star rookie defenseman, Mason Woodward, match that? That's what happened with Ross Scott. He got completely taken out of the game. So let's finish up part one of this podcast with some season trends with the best to give us the trends of this season. Joe, there's a lot of trends that you can kind of point at when you preview these two juggernauts coming together with the Whip Snakes facing the defending champs, Archers. What's one thing that you're looking out for in this one?
Yeah, one trend I'm looking at is just how good these teams are in their 32-second offense, right? Last year, we saw with the first year of the rule, we saw a gap between 52-second efficiency, 32-second efficiency. There were a lot of teams that struggled to figure out the shorter clock. Archers figured it out first. A couple teams followed. Some teams never did. This year, the gap has shrunk. The smart teams are figuring it out. The rule change to prevent poles from facing off has been a plus, in my opinion. We're seeing face-off guys face off. That's what we're going to see between Joe Nardella and Mike Sisselberger, two guys who can win face-offs to themselves, win it to wings, create offense off it. And then their wings can really get into the offense and maximize that 32-second clock. I've loved watching some of these young Whipsnakes midfielders on the wings. Adam Patras can absolutely fly. He is like a throwback midfielder, so unique. Whether he's coming off the faceoff wings or inverting, he can do a lot for them and has been so dangerous alongside Colin Squires and Joe Nardella as part of that faceoff unit. Then on the other side, you have Coach Brian Kavanaugh's substitution game and his schemes that we talked about, getting Trey LeClaire, you know, an extra 20 feet in the sub game. He's awesome with creating those advantages off the faceoff. Sisselberger and company can create that and get into early offense, whether they're subbing on Grant first, subbing on Grant last. They're always mixing it up, making it difficult for teams to match up. I think that's going to be an absolute chess match. Just the face-off units against each other and then the sub game that ensues. Both these teams really make the most out of the 32-second clock.
Now, as far as like the league as a whole, is anything that's kind of stood out to you different this year as opposed to previous seasons?
One thing that stood out, yeah, is just the obvious takeaway from this year is the rookie class, right? They delivered, and then some. I think we were all looking at like the three-headed monster of O'Neal, Schellenberger, and Kavanaugh and how excited we were for them. And all of them had great rookie seasons and will have phenomenal pro careers. But the list goes much, much deeper than that, right? There are guys beyond that who we expected to show out, like Ajax Zapatello or Liam Entenmann. And then guys in the later rounds who were absolute steals. Patras, like I mentioned, Levi Anderson, TJ Malone, all guys who, no coincidence, are suiting up on Sunday. So the rookie class is the big talking point. A thing that they do exceptionally well is shoot the two-pointer. We saw over 15% from two-point range. Credit that to a lot of the young guys, Graham Bundy Jr., Brennan O'Neal, second-year players like Tucker Dordovic can sling it. I think players are getting better and better playing above the cage. We are going to see two-point shooting percentage increase year over year. As far as the relationship between two-pointers, one-pointers, like it's never been closer. One-point shooting percentage actually hit an all-time low since 2019. Shooting that too, especially in the right time, whether that's transition or on the power play, is worth your while. So finding 15-yard shooters who can sling it. We saw the Cannons have a lot of success with that. We saw the Outlaws have success with it. I think that's going to be a thing that GMs target in the draft moving forward, and that gap between two-pointers and one-pointers is only going to shrink even more.
Yeah, having Bundy on the podcast earlier this season, he mentioned his release was kind of like a golf swing, and I can't unsee it. So shout out all you distance shooters. It's funny you bring up the Cannons. Like, they did make it a big part of their identity. A lot of those wins came from momentum swinging two-pointers, either in that second or third quarters. And they really could pull away from these teams. But you saw it in the quarterfinals. Like, what do you guys think? Like, if you make it, like, so much a part of your identity, are you more susceptible to kind of laying an egg like that, you think?
So I think it's just a matter of right time, right place, right? And coaches seem to embrace it. If you have players who have enough self-awareness to know I am a two-point guy or I'm not a two-point guy, you know what your shot is like, right? As long as you're not sabotaging the team because you think, you know, oh, here's a great opportunity, then I think coaches are generally leaning into it. The ones I've spoken with seem to be pretty big fans of, you know, the sort of momentum shift that can be contained in a two-point shot. You know, as long as it's the right time, right place for it. You're always going to have some players who maybe feel, you know, hey, now's my time. And, you know, when it goes sailing wide or it doesn't make it all the way to the goal or something like that, they're going to be second-guessed by their coaches and, you know, rightfully so. But I think they're largely embracing the trend of, you know, being able to kind of capitalize on these. And players have indicated as well that it is something that affects them. You know, when one is made, they can kind of, you know, feel the shift in the energy. And, you know, on both sides, if you give one up, it feels like even more than just 2 points. You know, if you're doing something well and then all of a sudden somebody comes down and their counterattack is worth twice as much as your last goal. You know, psychologically, both coaches and players have kind of indicated that's a really big deal. So I'd expect it to continue moving forward, you know, unless either you guys have heard some coaches kind of negatively speaking on it. You know what? Now that I say that, I did remind myself.
There it is.
I did hear one coach. Now that I say that, one coach was not a big fan of the two-point shot. That was Coach Bill Tierney himself. Not really a believer in it. Doesn't quite love it.
He'll come around.
Yeah, you know, maybe we'll see. We'll see what happens with him. Didn't quite love it early on. Even after Rylan Reese had scored one, he was still kind of like, yeah, but still.
So, yeah. You know.
Well, if you remember that Water Dog stretch where they missed their first 18, I wouldn't be a fan either at that point. Now, those transition twos, if you're a trailer and you can just crow hop into it, nothing better. Joe, what do you think about this play? You think it works every time? If hopefully you'll like this. I just thought of it, and I think it's genius. Spain pick and roll. The guy who pops out, he's got so much space, obviously, because it's the Spain pick and roll. And then everyone crashed in the net, so you screen the goalie. Low shot. Boom. Two-pointer every time. He loves it.
I'd have to see it. I don't know. You draw it up for the right shooter. I don't know how it's going to work.
Well, that is a great way to end this podcast appearance from the one and only Joe Keegan. Joe, appreciate you coming back, and we'll get to the Championship Media Day interviews. Thanks so much for joining.
Appreciate it, guys. See you in Philly.
We now welcome on our first guest of the Championship Preview Megapod.
Whoa.
New captain for the playoff run, Ryan Ambler. Ryan, how you feeling?
Great. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you, Ryan. Just describe what this Championship Media Day is like for you, and how are you feeling ahead of Sunday?
It's pretty cool. This is different from what I've seen in years past. It's really cool to see all of like the different podcasts and media outlets. And it's unique to, you know, be here back in Philadelphia to try and run it back.
Speaking of being back in Philly, trying to run it back, has last year you feel prepared you in any way for this year? Are you a little more comfortable or less nerves heading into this weekend?
I don't know. That's a good question. I haven't thought about it much. I think what our coaching staff and, you know, Tom and the rest of the leaders do a good job of is just making sure that we're focused on, you know, the next opponent. And I think we tried to do that. Like, that was the sentiment in film. We were watching a lot of the bad things we did against the Chaos this past week, and, you know, talked about how, you know, this is the last one, and, you know, every one of those little turnovers can compound into, you know, a pretty big mistake. And we're just trying to get ahead of our game plan and make sure that we're executing properly. So I think there's good nerves, right? Like, being back in a championship, there always brings like some type of little pressure and stress to it. So I wouldn't say that I slept a lot this week.
Now, the overarching sentiment from Coach Chris Bates and yourself and guys like Grant, amen, this last stretch of the season here has been playing for Tom.
Yeah.
He went down with that season-ending injury. For a guy like yourself who's played with him all throughout the PLL,
yeah,
the two last members of that original Archer squad, and you go back to the Princeton days, what's that message mean to you, and what's it mean to you to still be and carrying the torch of that leadership mantle that Shriver had?
Yeah, I mean, we're doing this for him. He's one of one. I think Grant put it perfectly last week in the press conference. You know, you don't replace him, like, and none of us try to. If anything, you know, we're trying to sort of emulate the things that he has put into place for us as a culture and as an organization. And, you know, we think a lot about that, and we're intentional. And I think a lot of that comes from preparation, comes from, you know, confidence, and it comes from being there for your teammates. So it's, you know, it kills me because he's one of my best friends in the world, right? Like, that guy helped me move into my freshman year dorm, whatever, 10, 12 years ago. It's kind of crazy. And along the way, you know, I look up to him as someone that I follow as a role model, a leader, you know, obviously a really close friend. And I wish he was on the field with us because he would do some pretty special things, as you guys saw in the championship game last year. But this is for him, and it's pretty cool that, you know, we don't need to say that per se. You just sense it. Like, when he went down in Utah, everyone flipped a switch and was like, we're going to go play for that guy. And you see it in your play. It's not just talking about it. It's being about it. And I think that comes from him, right? Like, he's not a big talker. He shows. You know, he steps up. You know, he walks the walk, and we've just tried to do that as best as we can.
Now, we've heard nothing but good things about Tom and his contributions,
yeah,
both on and off the field, but we also hear a lot of that same stuff about you. You know, I mean, if I can get
you
here.
Thank you.
How do you feel about the title? I'm sure you've probably heard it somewhere along the line.
Yeah.
Your favorite player's favorite player.
I don't know.
Like, how does that feel to kind of hear that that's, you know, the impact you've had on the game?
I mean, he and I talk every single day, so we kind of joke about it. I think he put it in an Instagram post one day for, like, PLL Day 5 or 6 years ago. It's nice coming from him, you know. but again, you know, he's the type of guy and teammate that celebrates everything, not just a goal or an assist, you know, running hard out of the box, getting back on defense, showing up on time. It's little things that you know, are celebrated by Tom. And I think that's really important. And I think you see it across the rest of our team, you know, when we're executing on the little details, good things usually happen. So, yeah, it's nice to have that title, I guess. But, you know, he's one of my boys. So it's funny to throw that back and forth.
Last question for you, Ryan, here. Yeah. Just no one runs out of the box as hard as you.
Yeah. Well, who knows?
You coming down, just starting the offense with that purpose, amen, mentioned in the post-game press conference that Tom really embodies. What's kind of helped you to formulate some of those personal traits that Tom has as well, but that your game is just all about?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I think it goes back to, like, when I was growing up, when I was a little kid, my dad always talked about, you know, controlling what you can, and he was always upset when people jogged onto the field. He never understood it. And I think that he and I would always talk about, like, the way you carry yourself, the way that you're running onto the field, like, disruption that it would cause. And with all of these new shot clocks, subbing rules, you know, Coach Kavanaugh is a mastermind at the box. I don't know if you guys have seen that or if you appreciate it, but the way that he runs that box when we're humming, it's because of the way we're substituting. And I think they've enforced that too. It's like, if you're able to get to the corner of the box or even at the midline and you can run in as fast as you can and potentially, you know, cause some distraction and chaos, good things typically happen. And I think that we do that as a team. And when we do that, it's a lot of fun to watch. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but Dyson Williams last week, right before Trey LeClaire's goal, was just sprinting across the field. And you saw it on film. You were like, holy shit, what the hell is happening? Like, he is flying. And he took a pole with him, cleared space, and we score a goal. And, like, that's the stuff that we celebrate. So, I don't know if that fully answers your question because I rambled on a little bit. But, like, that's my feel on it.
Not PTSD from the dad being angry at people jogging off, but it definitely
is in the back of my mind where I'm like, if I walk onto this field, he's probably gonna have some words for me.
You don't want to get Mr. Ambler.
No, you
upset.
Can't. No, his face will get all red. He'll throw his stick in his hat. That's what he did when I was a kid.
Ryan, thanks so much for the time and good
thanks
luck.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, appreciate it, guys.
Now we now welcome on defending champion head coach of the Utah Archers, Chris Bates. Coach Bates, how are you feeling?
Excited. It's fun to be back in Philly. You know, we said on Wednesday on our weekly team call, like, all right, we got to, you know, minimize the distractions as best we can. And, you know, this stuff is fun, don't get me wrong. And it's important, right? It's important for the league. But we're excited to get on the field and just kind of make this as much business as usual as we can. But it's also the championship. So all the stuff that's around it is really exciting to see the growth of the league and the coverage and the interest. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, the one game left to defend the crown, the crown here. Just what have you done throughout the week to make it seem like a regular week for your crew? And going into practice, are you practicing tonight ahead of?
Just a little kind of throw through, but you know, you look at all. I'm a coach's coach, right? You watch NFL guys, you hear what they talk about, and to the extent that you can keep your patterns the same and do the same things, I joke that I'd prefer to be on the road in some ways. I don't get me wrong, like Philly, I'm happy as hell it's here. But, you know, I'm like, I could go run to my barber this morning. And then my wife's like, hey, we can, you know, we have your truck. Can we go pick up this piece of furniture? And I'm like, and I left my glasses at the barber. Now I'm late. I'm like, You know, I just want to be here. I'm good in the hotel by myself, just getting my mojo going. But, you know, to answer your question, it's trying to just do the same things and not make this more than it is. Focus on the things we can continue to get better on. Focus on our opponent. Focus on our game plan. And then, you know, come Sunday, it's like, all right, dude, like, we just got to execute it. You know, we got to win some faceoffs, make some saves, make some stops, score some goals. Like, it's as easy as that.
You mentioned being a coach's coach. Who are, like, some of your coaching inspirations or people you kind of take notes from when you prepare for a game?
Well, I mean, at the end of the day, from a lacrosse standpoint, I was blessed to coach with Randy Void at Drexel. He was my first sort of role model, gave me my first chance. And then, you know, I always tell people, you know, Coach Tierney and Coach Adele were just the two guys, you know, when I was sort of coming up through the ranks, both as a fan in college and then as an assistant and then as a head coach, like just watching how Princeton took that run back in the 90s. And then the big man, Coach Adele, you know, my good coach and friend, Scott Marr, coached there, so I had access to go to some practices and just hear how he went about his business. So from a lacrosse standpoint, those are the guys. But then, you know, anybody, you know, I read the sports page and watch, you know, how coaches handle themselves and read their quotes. And, like, you know, that's my office in some regard. You know, watching, not necessarily SportsCenter or highlights, but watching and reading about how guys prepare their teams and the process that they go through. You know, my book is, or my, you know, bookcase is just littered with whoever, Tom Coughlin, Mike Shanahan, Pat Riley, you know, any of those books that we're all, as coaches, you're all sharing that stuff. You know, Legacy is a great book. You know, if you talk to a coach, like, you know, the All Blacks rugby, like, that's, it's just a great, and you go, huh, I got ideas here. Like, and you're always just looking to keep fresh and stay on the cutting edge and implement something that's going to help your program. So I've been lucky to be able to, you know, make a life and a career doing this.
Now, Coach, post-game on Saturday night after your semifinal win, you reflected on the season and how there were some more ups and downs compared to last year, 6-4 going into the playoffs, but you got the Western Conference bye, you right to the semis. You're right back where you want to be. Expand a little more on how you've been able to peak at the right time going into September here.
I think we all sort of had a gut sense that, you know, last year was an 8-2, kind of an easy ride in some ways. We just kind of were firing on all cylinders. This year, you know, as you mentioned, like a little bit of up and down, and I just feel like having some experience both as a staff and you know, within our locker room, that we didn't want to peak too soon. We didn't want to kind of raise the red flag and get, you know, overly concerned. We had a sense we're going to be in the playoffs, right? Because it's hard not to, you know, we had enough early success that we're like, okay, if we kind of hold serve here, we're at least going to be a playoff team. We had some goal advantage. We had some early wins. So I think by design, we, you know, from an energy standpoint and kind of an emotion standpoint, we kind of wanted to let the thing unfold a little bit. And then, frankly, when we got to Utah, things clicked a little bit. You know, that game against the Redwoods on Friday night, like the fans were behind us, and it was a huge overtime win. Like, they were there with us, so you could feel that energy in the stadium. And then, you know, Vano has a big goal, and you're like, oh shit, like, this is fun, like, this is, you know, and you got a good vibe, and that was exciting. But then the next night, you know, you have a playoff game. Like, I don't care what you say, like, we didn't want to play in the quarters if we could avoid it. If you can avoid it, you just, so that game to win the first Western Conference title, you know, we're going to put that on our banner somewhere someday, or take pride in that we won the Western Conference when this thing continues to evolve like it is. But then that win puts us in a position where we're right in the semi. So I think, you know, we just started to hit our groove and kind of by design, you know, wanted to do that. And then Utah kind of gave us that opportunity to be in our home city, have an exciting overtime win, and then Saturday have that sort of real playoff atmosphere, have the Utah fans. They were dialed into every play. They were dialed in. They knew what was at stake. It was a home game for us, and we knew, we said afterwards, like, how about the Utah Archers now? Like, we are now clearly the Utah Archers. And it was sort of a name before, but after that weekend. So I think all that sort of buoyed us. And then we had a great, you know, week in the semis, and now here we are. So I think we're just, you know, we've always wanted this moment for us to play our best lacrosse, and we haven't. We haven't yet. Like, we've said it on Wednesday, like, we feel like our best lacrosse is still ahead of us. So hopefully we get that game on Sunday and hoist it again.
you know, you mentioned, and rightfully so, a huge Utah crowd that was very active and very supportive. Now, heading into the Philadelphia area, there's a deep Philadelphia connection with your team. There's also some significant Philadelphia ties for your opponents here. So I would imagine there's going to be maybe a divided house in the crowd. Like, if you had some neutral kind of Philly area fans looking for one side or another as the leader of your team, how would you pitch them on being Archers fans this weekend?
I like it. Good question. I could go a couple different ways with that answer. I'll try not to be funny. My wife always tells me I'm not funny. You know, I just think for us, you know, we play the game the right way. The ball moves, like the skill on the offensive end is you know, it's beautiful when the ball is popping. You know, so I think there's a lot of certainly talent and excitement on that end. You know, you got Sis facing off, and he's fun to root for. You know, personality, but he just is a gamer and a warrior. And then look at us defensively, right? I mean, I just think we bring some thump, you know, with Haas, you know, with Moose, you know, Warren Jeffrey. You know, we've played well. When the defense plays well, we're obviously in every game. And, you know, honestly, I think when you watch the shorties, you know, I think we have as good a shorty group as there is in the league. But yeah, like we want this Philly crowd running for us. And I joke, you know, I coach at St. Andrews, which is a boarding school down in Delaware, a place I love. There's two buses, there's 40 people coming up. Like, so we're gonna have a good vibe. You know, we got Ambler and Moore and Bates and Resch and Ament and some Philly love. I got a box full of 30 people, and so we feel like we're gonna be well represented. It's gonna be a beautiful day, and you know, so come out and support the Archers, everybody.
Now, Coach, you
going back to the peaking at the right time conversation here, just there's no team hotter than the Whipsnakes. Six straight wins here. Their last loss, I believe, came when that 16-11 defeat you handed them in week four. What's it been, without going into too much of the specifics, game plan, and what have you, what's different about the Whipsnakes from the last time you've seen them?
Well, I think they know themselves that much more, right? I think I give Coach Staggs and his staff credit. I give their vets credit because they've just bought into sort of a new feel for who they are, mainly on the offensive end of the field, you know, but they brought in a new long pole. So, you know, they've just integrated new players, and that always takes a little bit of time. So, you know, I think they've just kind of, you know, figured out who they are, and they're playing very selfless offensively for sure. They've got some different weapons. You know, you're now seeing Levi Anderson, you know, do what he's doing. They're bringing Ryan Conrad, which is a smart vet who's won at every level. So that's another guy who's been there and has experience. You know, Loyola kid Adam Poitras, you know, playing well. So, you know, and you know, TJ's like, so the knowns are the knowns, but then those other pieces they fit in on the offensive end have really helped. And then, you know, Krebs has been good in goal, and defensively they're good. You know, they're good year in, year out. So, you know, we've got our work cut out for us. We have a healthy respect for them. You're all at the ball on Sunday, and you see, you know, who's doing what, and try to make some adjustments. But there's not a whole lot you do at this point, except, you know, hopefully you pick up some ground balls, make some saves, and shoot the ball by their goalie. And you know, it's not much more complicated than that. Like, you have to play well to win a championship, and they're playing very well. So that, you know, our eyes are wide open. Like, this is a pick 'em game based on a lot of reasons, and you know, it should be a really good one.
Just last one for your coach here. Just, I wrote about it last year, Reed Bowering coming in for the just one game, scores that goal in the championship. And you've seen it again this year. Colby Barrs coming in for the semifinals on late notice. Jack Vanoverbeek for the last weekend of the regular season. We talked to Ryan Amler about it, for playing for Tom, the sentiment going into the postseason. How is that overall culture been able to manifest through 1 through 25, not just 1 through 19?
No, I appreciate that question, because I think we as the entire organization take pride in being able to get young guys comfortable and confident, you know, playing their best across. That comes from the locker room first and foremost. You know, where you're, if you're here, you're here for a reason. We believe in you. It's okay to make mistakes. but we want to get you comfortable and confident so that you're playing your game. This is a game where, yeah, there are X's and O's, but players have to make plays, and you have to play with some confidence and not a fear of looking over your shoulder. So we've been able to integrate. You know, if Cam doesn't go on Sunday, we've got five rookies in the lineup. Like, that's a big number. 5 out of 19 is a big number. So Mason has stepped in and done a really good job. Bo's been as advertised. He's as good as anybody in the league right now at the shorty position. You know, Dice, you knew if he was going to get on the field and somebody was going to, you know, get the ball on a stick, he was going to finish it because that's what he does. But then, to your point, you know, Bargy comes in and plays well. And then Vano, you know, honestly, at the end of the season, it was a moment where I'm like, do I put this guy in this position or not? And, you know, we just said, let's give him a shot. Like, we picked up Jackson Morrill as a possibility. And Jackson can play. Like, but we just said, you know what, let's give Vano a chance. And Vano delivered, you know, Van overtime or whatever people are calling. Like, but, you know, just that play, I think, embodies your question, you know, or what you're alluding to. Like, for him to just go, you know what, I'm going to go make a play at this moment. Like, that was as exciting an end to a game as you could possibly imagine. And that's a rook playing his first game. Like, so it comes from Tom. It comes from Ryan. It comes from Haas. It comes from Grant. Where, you know, you're expected, if you're here, you're a professional. Right? And you're expected to execute, perform, prepare, know your stuff, and go out and make plays. There's no time for sitting on your hands and waiting for something to happen. You got to go grab it, and we encourage that. And you know, within our systems, you know, we try to allow for that as well.
Coach, we thank you so much for the time, and good luck on Sunday.
Fun to talk to you guys. I appreciate it.
Appreciate you. We now welcome on 2023 championship game MVP Brett Dobson. Brett, how are you feeling ahead of Sunday's big game?
Good. I'm excited. I felt like once the game ended and it got to Monday, I was ready to play again, and been kind of chomping at the bit to get going here, and I can't wait for it to be Sunday.
Now, coming off a stifling performance like you had against Chaos in the semifinals, how much confidence does that give you going into the championship?
It gives me some confidence, but at the end of the day, you try to flush it out of the system. I usually find when you have a big game like that, you tend to get kind of humbled the next week. So, you know, taking accounts and deleting this somewhat of the social media this week to not really see that, not really be that of an effect, is something I've had to do. But I'm not too worried about it. I think, you know, my play is an indicator of, you know, how good the guys in front of me were playing and how much confidence the offense was giving me.
Now, I think goalies kind of have the reputation of being, you know, superstitious, not wanting to change anything up before games or, you know, in season or anything like that. Are you someone who follows standard kind of superstitions or protocols each week?
Yeah, a little bit. I try to. I feel like in the middle of the season, it's a little difficult when you're doing the camp grind, coaching a bunch of camps, going to a game. But I think since the postseason started, it's been pretty strict routine and kind of what I'm doing and how I'm treating my body going into the playoffs.
So speaking of treating your body in certain ways, you know, heading into the playoffs, playoff beard, playoff haircuts, that kind of stuff. I know it's obviously huge in hockey culture. Playoffs not as long in lacrosse. Is it still the same thing? Like, would you go shave or anything heading into this weekend?
Yeah, I know you can't really tell. Obviously, it's a podcast, but I got the beard growing a little bit longer than I normally do. Just kind of trim around it, and then I got the race car stripes and the mullet a couple weeks ago. So that's what I've been doing for the playoffs.
Let's go, man. So, Brett, you obviously made the title-clinching save last year. Pretty epic finish to that one. What have you learned from that whole experience around the game, around the week, preparation into it? Really anything that will help you going into Sunday?
Yeah, prepare for everything. Anything can happen in a championship. between last week and this week, it's not over till the final second. I'm sure... that was an indicator of that last year. So you just got to be ready for everything. You got to give your full attention to it and just make sure that you don't get too lost in the sauce of how things went last year and just kind of focus on what's ahead of you and stay even keel.
Now, we got to get you out of here a second. So I wanted to ask you before we let you go, had Ryan Ambler over here, and I asked him about kind of the moniker of being your favorite player's favorite player and just what he means to your clubhouse and everything like that. He, you know, humbly deferred, kind of brought it back on Tom's shoulders. So I wanted to ask you about Ryan Ambler and his contributions to the team.
Ryan's been awesome. Since I've been here day one, he's been a tremendous teammate. Although Tom usually wears the C on his jersey. You know, Ryan getting that luxury of doing it recently has been awesome and, you know, hasn't skipped a beat. He's a great dude, great leader, great guy in the locker room, and a type of guy that's genuinely invested in how your life is on and off the field. And I think that When you look at his presence in our locker room, it shows as to why we have so many guys that love each other. And I think that he's a big part of it and big part of making you feel welcome at home like it's a family straight from day one.
Brett, thanks so much for joining the show and good luck in the championship.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We now welcome on Whipsnakes head coach Jim Stagnita. Coach, thank you so much for joining the show.
My pleasure.
Now, we're here at Championship Media Day, blowing it out for you, making it everything you wanted and more, of course. No, just going into this championship weekend here, what's it been like to go now for a fourth time and going for your third title?
You know, it seems like a while. I mean, honestly, and I think Matt Rambo said it earlier, or actually Joe Nardella said it, like we haven't won a playoff game in a couple years. So I think what, you know, and I've known this because it's what I've done my whole life, right? There's no guarantees. You know, you've got to embrace it when you have the chance because you never know when you're going to get back and you never know when you're going to have an opportunity again. And we've talked about that over the years with our teams. And, you know, as I continue to, you know, to do this and coach, I have a greater appreciation for every moment like this and every opportunity like this. I work with corporations and pro teams and, you know, in the area of kind of culture and leadership development. And one of the messages that, you know, that I is important that I share with them is, you know, I was always looking for the next thing, right, to continue to climb that mountain. And that's a problem with high achievers when I really never sat back and enjoyed, you know, the victories along the way. So, you know, for me, again, at this point in my career, I've had some successes. And certainly, you've been at this long, I've had my failures. But, you know, coming back here is something that I'm going to enjoy and I'm relishing, and I'm glad that I get to do it with this group.
Now, do you feel like there are some lessons you have taken from or you could be able to take from your previous championship experience and apply it to this one? Or are they so different that you kind of have to start fresh this year?
I think they're all different. You know, the first one was the first year. And, you know, none of us really knew, right, what to think and what it was going to be like. And it was an amazing, you know, it was an amazing experience. It was an amazing game. I mean, people forget we were up big. And then we had to tie it with a play out of a timeout with seconds left. And, you know, then we won it in overtime. And the next year was the bubble, right, which was a completely different, you know, experience. And while people say we dominated and went undefeated, we barely got through the semifinal. You know, Jeremy Sieverts had to bounce one up in a corner. And we were down, I think, in the championship and came back. You know, then we go on and have a good year and lose to a good chaos team. We didn't play great that day. And then we go 9-1. I mean, best year ever. And we go out in the first round. They're all different. You know, they really are. And this team, you know, we haven't really had rookies that have contributed over the years. Our roster was full. I mean, our guys were, you know, our guys had their spots locked down. There was no reason to think we would need, you know, to turn over the roster. And then last year happened and, we had to make some changes, and some guys, you know, kind of aged out, and some guys became comfortable, and, you know, we were fortunate enough during this season, you know, that these young guys are, you know, were kind of the, you know, the, they were the answer. They just excited the older guys again and got them. You know, they rejuvenated them, and then they just brought, they've never been here before, so, you know, they brought this new level of excitement. But, you know, to get back to your question, I think every year is different, how you do it. We were, you know, early on we were a defensive juggernaut, and that was our thing. And now we're a little more balanced, and I think there's a couple ways now that we can win games.
Coach, you mentioned the youthful energy and how much that's really revitalized the locker room. Talk a little bit about TJ Malone and just kind of how he exudes just positivity. The Whipsnakes posted a huddle breakdown before your semifinal game. He's like, come on, guys, let's just have fun. And everyone's like, yeah, nice one, TJ. And I remember, I think you said, like,
yeah, hey, DJ, that gave me goosebumps. It was so inspiring.
having a guy like him.
He's the ultimate teammate. He has no ego, none. Like, he will do anything you ask him to do. There is not a bone in his body that you would say this guy is a spoiled professional athlete or a prima donna. He is the nicest kid. The guys love him. But he is a competitor. You know, when he is on the field and the game starts, you know, Johnny Nostrand said it wasn't my line. Johnny Nostrand, who, you know, I've known forever, grew up with Johnny, he's a coach, coached him at Haverford. Nody said he's the nicest assassin you'll ever meet. And he is, you know, he is all of that. And he's coachable. And he continues to get better. And, you know, I'm, as I say over and over, you know, I tell the guys this every year, if I didn't have sarcasm, I probably wouldn't have a personality. And he is the best with that. You can say whatever you want to him, and he's just polite, but the kid can flat out play, and he makes other people better. And, you know, he's the guy. You know, you got to pick someone out to marry your daughter, he's the guy.
You know, that makes grabbing him when you did in the draft even more impressive. It's a very, very, you know, tremendous year you put together GM-wise, from the draft picks to the during season trade and signings. What was your initial reaction when you found out Ryan Conrad was going to be joining your team, as far as what it was going to bring to your organization and the ability to kind of expand your offense?
Yeah, I've reached out regarding Ryan in the past. I just, you know, I missed on him after college in that draft. He got taken just before we had a chance in the initial draft. And his skill set and what he does is everything that I look for in a player in the middle of the field. He can play offense. He can play defense. He can invert. He's a winner. He's played on, you know, in national championships. He's, you know, was in the World Games. He's won a championship in this league. You know, if you look at his resume, it's, you know, he wasn't lighting the world on fire maybe this year during the season, but sometimes you just need a new environment or a little different opportunity or to be used in a little different way. You know, people continue to say, you know, we've never really seen him invert like he's inverted for you. To me, that was a no-brainer. Like, that's, you know, he can do that. And he can break it down, and, you know, he can also feed the ball when he's back there. And, you know, it was a piece that, you know, maybe the last piece we needed, you know, going into the playoffs. And, you know, I look at this, and, you know, we don't have Brad Smith, who will be back. But Brad Smith's one of the top 10, 12 players in the league. And Tucker Dordovic. Like, we've pretty much done this without those guys. And we needed just one more, you know, we needed one more weapon out there. Because, you know, Levi was just starting to come around. Certainly Potts was playing great. You know, you throw Heacock in there, who's really kind of found his stride. And, you know, you got TJ. Now we become a little bit more difficult to cover. And I don't think we were that difficult to cover in the beginning of this year or throughout most of last year. And, you know, Ryan makes us more dynamic, as do those young guys.
Now, Coach, just your Whip Snakes and the Archers are two of the most consistent winning squads in the league throughout since the inception in 2019. A lot of that, from your perspective, I think comes from what you mentioned on the championship media day post the podium. Just, you have expectations that are higher than a lot of these players have for themselves. How do you balance that without overwhelming them? And
I, you know, a lot of our conversations, I don't lay it all out there in front of everybody, you know, on the team. I don't think that's fair, but I tell them in the beginning, and I kind of tell them first what my expectations are for the whole group. And I think they're realistic. I'm really fortunate, right? I had Michael Earhart for a number of years. I've had Channy you know, since the Charlotte days. I've had Matt. You know, there's older guys who are able to tell the younger guys, hey, if you do what he asks you to do, and if you understand that he truly thinks you're capable of doing all this, you're going to be successful and we're going to be successful. You may not always love the fact that he tells you that, you know, you're not doing things at the level he wants them to be done or the way he wants them to be done. But, you know, if you buy into that, I promise you, okay, that you're going to be a better player and we're going to be a better team. And I have those conversations with them individually. Like, hey, this is what I'm seeing. This is what you need to do better. And these are our calls during the week individually. And I say, it's because I truly believe you're capable of doing this. And there's I do this for a living, so my wife says I'm much better at doing it than I am at executing it. But, you have to develop a level of trust. If they trust you and think you have their best interests in mind, they'll do anything you ask them to do. And, you know, it takes a little while or the right people to build up that trust. But if you're just coming into the team and you're young, and Matt Rambo and Matt Dunn, right, and Kyle Bernlohr and Mike Chanichuk and Jake Bernhardt tell you that, you know, you got a great opportunity here and, you know, he will get you and make you the best version of yourself. Sometimes it's not going to be easy, and sometimes you're going to have to put up with an earful. But, you know, trust that he has your best interests in mind. And that's what helps me to get there quicker than if I, you know, we're not in college. I don't get to build up recruiting relationships and, you know, like you do there.
You know, so we've discussed a few times about Michael Earhart's departure and what it's meant as far as, you know, Matt Dunn's elevation and his evolution as a captain. Would you say this year there are ways you can recognize within yourself that you've evolved as a coach?
I continue to evolve. And I've evolved more as I've aged and became more experienced and was a father and, you know, all of those things. Early in the year, we were 0-2. And we sat down with the captains and Joe Nardella. And at that point, you know, I wasn't, you know, I think you got to be true to yourself. And, you know, last year I pushed hard, right? I pushed real hard. And some guys didn't respond, right? Everybody wanted everything to be okay and good all the time. So I started out this year on a little bit more of taking, you know, a little easier approach to it. And after two games, I sat with the captains. They're like, it's not what we need. It's not what we want, right? And Matt Dunn last year probably was one of those guys because he didn't, you know, he's hurt and he struggled through a year who, you know, probably thought I could back off a little bit. But now he was looking through it for a different lens and sees the whole overline, you know, and the responsibility that comes with, you know, with my job, and then the responsibility came with his job as being a captain. And, you know, I think at that point, you know, listening to Jake and talking to Jake, you know, they said to me, we need the coach Stagnita that's going to challenge us, that's going to push us, that's going to demand of us. And I said, good, because I can't coach the way I've been coaching these first two games. And then it started to turn around. At the same time, I pick and choose my fights better. I'm going to say kinder, gentler, but I certainly know when to press and when not to. I've gotten a lot better at, you know, waiting 24 hours and looking at film before I make any, you know, decisions or statements or comments after. And, kind of little things that, you know, things that I develop people to do in my business. I'm, as my wife says, I've got to do a better job of, of doing that with my in my personal approach to it. So, and I have my communication is better. The I let guys make decisions. They're not any different than what I would have made. They weigh in on everything. And I tend to start conversations, by telling them first why I'm having the conversation, instead of allowing them to, use their own perspective and try to figure it out. So yeah, I'd like to think I continue to get better. And there's something to be said, I still have, my kids are still fairly young, they're in their 20s, but to be around guys like this all the time, and the young guys and the older guys, you can't help but, to stay, to stay involved, in line, enlightened, all of those things. They inspire me, and I learn from them too every day. I have a bunch of coaches on my team too, which helps.
No, absolutely. And a new coach on your staff, you mentioned in the pregame press conference just how well Drew Snyder evens you out, and contrast of personalities rather with your high expectations and his even keeledness. That play he drew up in the 2019 championship to get Rambo that tying goal kind of stands out. But for new pro lacrosse fans, kind of take us through what you've seen his journey like the last decade, really, from the time from the Outlaws to now through the Whipsnakes.
I brought Drew in the Outlaws, and the role he had to play then was a D-Mitty role. I mean, we were good. And that was a spot that, we needed him. And he just, he embraced it. He did it. I don't think it was necessarily right in his wheelhouse at the time, but set his ego aside and had a tremendous year. And we had a great year, went to the finals, and he just kept getting better and better and better. And, what he learned early on was, I can still create offense being a defensive midfielder. And he was one of the first that was really able to do that. I mean, he could shoot the shit out of the ball. He'd take the ball from one end of the field to the other. He could run, and he scored goals. And he took advantage of early offensive opportunities. Next year, my second year with Denver, we were undefeated in the regular season, and he played a much bigger role on the offensive end. But still, like Conrad, who, two Conrad reminds me of, could do everything, right? Had this, Swiss Army knife, had this diverse skill set. And
did you tell him to wear the 23 then for Snyder?
No, that was his go. And then, Drew just continued to evolve, and he's a winner. I mean, he's won, he won in Denver. Unfortunately, we had to make decisions when the league, when they added the Water Dogs, and we were a defense-oriented team, and it made it tough. We had to make some tough decisions, but he went on and, won a championship with the Water Dogs, and he won, won a championship in the World Games. So, he's just continued, to grow and evolve, and he's doing that this year as a coach. He came in and had all of these great ideas and this excitement, and kind of let it play out a little bit, but I kept saying to him, I think you're going to realize simpler is better, right? The less is more. And he's, really come to understand that and embrace it, and, is a great voice to have, and provides great insight. And again, he knows the game. He's played it at the highest level for a long time.
Last one.
Nope.
Coach Staggs, thanks so much for joining the show. Good luck in the championship.
I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, appreciate you.
It's good to see you.
So we now welcome on Whipsnakes midfielder Colin Heacock. Colin, welcome to the show. Thanks for doing this.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Championship is tomorrow by the time listeners are listening to this on Saturday morning. Yep. How are you feeling? What are the juices flowing like?
Yeah, I mean, obviously just really excited. Really just want to get it going. It's going to be a great weekend. Obviously the Archers are a very good team. We played them once before, but something we've just been harping on the second half of the season is really just focusing on ourselves and taking it one play at a time. So it should be a good day, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Colin, we know your history with Matt Rambo. Coming back all the way from the Maryland Terrapins, now the Maryland Whipsnakes.
what's it been like for you to kind of have this re-energized season for yourself? A hat trick in the semifinals has been awesome to watch. Yeah. What's that been like for you all season here?
Obviously, it's awesome when you get to play alongside, you know, one of your best friends. You know, it brings back memories from when we were at Maryland. So, you know, we talked about it a lot right after college, if we'd ever be able to get on the same team again. And now having Maryland across our chest, playing alongside one another, it's couldn't ask for anything more. So being able to compete for a championship with him, along with a bunch of other Terps, and you know, our teammates were just all really excited, and yeah, it should be an awesome time.
Now, walk us through the process of like finding out you were joining the team. You know, where were you when you found out, and you know, what was your reaction? Like, what were the first calls you made and everything?
I'm trying to think. I don't really remember exactly where I was, like the time when I found out, but you know, we had a pretty good idea, and Rambo and I, you know, obviously we talk every day, but we were kind of going back and forth, and you know, once I realized, and I talked to Coach Stagnito, once the time became available, that I had the opportunity to come over to the Whipsnakes, it was, you know, obviously kind of like a no-brainer to team up with a bunch of my old teammates again, and again, put Maryland across my chest. So, yeah, I mean, it was definitely an exciting time. I think I called Rambo right away the second I signed the paper, and yeah, I couldn't be more thrilled.
But just to see your production rise this year, coming from a struggle season with, I mean, everyone struggled with the Chrome last year. Just, is that what you had attributed it to? A little more familiarity with Matt and your other fellow Terp?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it makes it your job a lot easier when you're playing alongside guys like, you know, Matt Rambo, Zed Williams. Obviously, TJ Malone's having a great year as a rookie. Then Levi Anderson, Adam Potras, you know, Mike Chanichuk. I can go on and on, but the guys I'm playing alongside of, you know, they make my job a lot easier. And obviously the locker room. We have a great relationship in the locker room, off the field. And, yeah, I mean, obviously they just help a lot tremendously. So playing alongside those guys, it, you know, sometimes my only job is just to kind of shoot the ball, and, you know, I'm very fortunate that sometimes it goes in.
It's been dialed.
Yeah.
It's been working. So now Kevin mentioned your success last weekend's game, you know, having the hat trick like you did. We noticed you dropped a little flex after one of the goals. How important to you is, like, or and how common as well, is kind of a little bit of gamesmanship, you know, or letting the emotions show like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's at the end of the day, you know, all the guys in this league, we're all good friends. Yeah, I mean, it was just the heat of the moment, just kind of all the emotions were going, and, you know, we try to feed off each other's energy, and, you know, last weekend's game was, you know, awesome. It started with Joe Nardella at the face-off X, and then obviously our defense and Krebs, you know, they did so well, so they kind of gave us a little burst of energy on the offensive side, and we just try to carry that along.
Now, Colin, we have a picture of you from the Final Four where you just look absolutely jacked in the stands watching the Terps.
Screaming.
For the Terps. They get that upset in the semifinals. Unfortunately, fall short in the championship, but you were in training camp by that time. So,
yeah.
What is your arm routine these days? How have you gotten so jacked the last couple of years?
You know, I don't even know what it is. It's my day-to-day kind of just looks like, you know, obviously I'll go out, practice some lacrosse, you know, work my full-time job, and then, you know, my second part-time job is taking care of Rambo. So, you know, it's, you know, that's a struggle. That right there is a workout in itself. So,
have you guys been roommates on the road?
Oh, yeah. We're roommates every weekend. And, yeah, I mean, we talk all week and whatnot. So, yeah, I'm his babysitter. He's my little brother. So he takes me away from any type of workouts. But, you know, dealing with him is a full-time job. So I'll consider that a workout.
Well, Colin, thanks so much for stopping by, and good luck in the championship.
Awesome. I appreciate you guys. Thanks.
We now welcome on Whipsnakes captain, close defenseman, Matt Dunn. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Happy to be here.
Championship is on Sunday. By the time listeners hear this, it will be Saturday. One day until you're able to take the field for the first time since 2021 with the championship on the line. How are you feeling? What are the jitters like right now?
Yeah, no jitters right now. We're still 2 days away. It's been a long week. We kind of had a short first round of the playoffs. It was a Monday, Labor Day, and then we played Saturday in Long Island, so that was a quicker week.
Right.
Now we're going Saturday to Sunday, so a longer week, and I think after the win last week, we're all pretty fired up, and I think we just want to play, and we're happy to be back together. So No jitters right now, just like really anxious to kind of get back together for practice tomorrow and get going here.
And now, would you say that, you know, your previous experience with postseason play is something that kind of helps you moving along now? You mentioned not really having jitters right now.
I think so. I think to a degree, just in the sense that, like, whenever you've done something, you tend to have a little bit of confidence just because it's a little less mysterious and you know that it's, like, it's just a game. It really is just another game. And no matter how many times you say that, you're still going to go out there and it's going to feel crazy at the beginning. And I was talking to Dan over there about it. Like, the first 5 minutes always feel crazy. But we've done a good job of really just, like, taking the pressure off the end result for a lot of our games and just playing the type of lacrosse the way we want to play it. So that's going to be our focus. And so I think having played in games before like this, just knowing that if you let the moment get too big, it can derail you from what you want to do. So really trying our hardest to over-communicate that, over-focus on, let's just do the things that have made us successful in the past and trust that that'll take care of where we want to be.
Now, you mentioned the longer turnaround compared to the quarterfinals. You're coming off 2-1-goal comeback victories in this postseason here. But this semifinal, what was this overtime like from your perspective guarding the presumptive MVP? We'll find out tonight, last night for you listeners. And just the back and forth, trading saves. What was it like to be a part of it?
It was wild. It was crazy. I was joking with somebody. I was like, you know, it was actually probably harder for people watching it than it was playing in it. I've watched games before, and when you watch it, you're not in it. Your adrenaline's maybe not going the same way. You have no control. So it can be really hard. Playing, it's still anxiety-inducing, but sometimes you're so in the moment when you're playing, you take the play as it is. When you're on defense, you're just defending the play. When your team has the ball, you're just kind of hoping the ball goes in. When it doesn't, you're like, I guess we're playing defense again. In hindsight, rewatching, it's even crazier. But in that moment, it was just – the whole game felt crazy. We kind of came back. It was an awesome game where we were just up and down, back and forth. It was a lot of fun to play in. It was pretty tiring. We played a lot of defense. The ball was going back and forth a lot. But it was definitely one of the crazier games I've ever been in. I don't know if I've been in an overtime that had gone back and forth with so many scoring opportunities before a goal finally went in.
Oh, my God, yeah. Shout out Brendan Krebs, man.
yeah, exactly. Big shout out Brendan Krebs.
Yeah, you know, so speaking of Brendan, just what has his game kind of brought? Because, you know, every goal is a little bit different. Their communication with the defenses and things like that. As his season has progressed, what have you noticed from him? Has he evolved a bit, you know, as a leader or taking on a heavier role in the communication aspect?
Yeah, he's got a great presence. And the way, like, we play defense, communication, like, a lot of times our defenders do it because, you know, we kind of are making decisions on the fly. But what Brendan's done a great job of, one, is just stopping the ball. Two, he's very athletic, so he kind of makes those plays where the ball maybe pops a little bit outside the crease, and it's a ground ball that maybe not every goalie would go after, and he makes the play. So he gets us some possessions back that way. And I think three, he's matured in the clearing game where, you know, sometimes he'll throw the passes for quick outlets and breaks, but he's gotten better of not throwing risky passes. And that's been something I've noticed in his evolution. And maturing throughout the years. I think he's getting more comfortable just kind of being that starting goalie, playing in big games. And really, you can sense that he's more confident playing in the goal and doesn't feel like, you know, every mistake matters so much, because as a goalie, you need a quick memory. You're going to give up shots. So I've noticed him kind of coming along and staying confident and believing in himself, which I think has been a huge thing for us.
Now, your head coach, Staggs, has really praised you throughout the season, your ascension as a leader, being named captain this season. With the loss of Michael Erhart, the retirement in the off season, what have you kind of learned from him leadership wise and taken from his style, and kind of, what else have you kind of formulated from your time as a loyal Blakefield coach and a Highland Park assistant coach this past spring?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. You can't fill Mike's shoes one for one with one person. Mike is a huge presence. He's one of the best players to ever play the game. He was a great leader also. He was a guy, he's ultra competitive. Guys respected him. He did a lot for the team. He was always the guy you went to for anything. It really was kind of just this huge presence. And so with Mike going, we kind of knew there was going to be a void in that leadership space. And so just understanding, like, he was a guy that always set the tone in practice. He was a guy that always in games when things weren't going well or if guys weren't doing stuff, wouldn't be afraid holding guys accountable and calling them out in his own way. And so just for us to understand that we didn't need that exact thing. Everybody leads in their own way. But there was going to be a void at the top of people we would all look to. And so I think for me, you know, Coach Stacks trusted me with a leadership position. So just trying to figure out how I could try to fill some of that void. But even more so, we've had a bunch of guys, Joe Nardella, Kyle Burnlord, Tim Muller, Roman Puglisi, Colin Squire, some younger guys, all kind of lead in their own ways, which I think is what's special about this team, where Jake Bernhardt and I are captains, but we have guys that are, you know, really leading in a lot of different ways, which has been really awesome.
Matt, leading the way right back to the title game here. We wish you all the luck, and thank you so much for stopping by.
Appreciate it, guys. Thanks for having me.
So we now welcome on Whipsnakes LSM, Colin Squires. Colin, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you joining. Just how are you feeling ahead of the championship game here? Are you ready to take the crown away from the Archers here?
Yeah, feel good. Feel good for sure. Body feels good. You know, good chemistry with the team going on. We're up in a nice hotel here in Philly. Already got some arcade games in the hotel with a couple of the boys. So, yeah, vibes are good and ready to rock and roll on Sunday.
What's the go-to arcade game?
I think there's two circulating around right now. The motorcycle racing game, oh, yeah. And then we got a Buckshot as well. Undefeated in the motorcycle racing game so far, so we'll see if that continues.
Hey, the wheels in the middle field, they're paying off.
So I want to go straight from that. You just mentioned playing some arcade games. Are you competitive in things other than lacrosse?
Yeah. The answer is I like to think so. I'm not sure if everybody will say that I am. You know, I consider myself an avid pickleball player. I consider myself pretty good at chess as well. We on the Whipsnakes, the Word Hunt and Game Pigeon have taken over the team. So I like to say those are probably my three, pickleball, Game Pigeon, and a little bit of chess as well.
They're not easy. You got to just, like, swipe your finger a bunch. Words you can.
It's more of a mental thing, for sure, yeah. I mean, I can't use your athleticism all the time in those, but definitely a mental game.
Who's been your roommate on traveling weekends this year?
Roman Puglisi, short stick D-mid from Maryland.
Love it, yeah. How's that relationship been forming off the field? Rope unit, got to represent.
It's awesome. Yeah. It's nice. They like to keep us in the same room, so you kind of built some chemistry with the guys. He's awesome. We kind of know each other's cadences on the weekends pretty good now. I let him work when he's got to work, and he lets me nap when I got to nap. So it's working out so far.
Now, Colin, you played close at Denver. What's the transition been like the last couple of seasons and to this year? Your head coach gave some praise for you after last game, called you the best cover LSM in the league. What's that transition been like to cover midfielders in the pro game?
It's been good for sure. You know, definitely, obviously, in college was way more comfortable playing down low, close defense. It's not too different guarding-wise, but off the ball, you know, and certainly, you know, in fill spots can be certainly different. I'm not necessarily one of the guys that's as used to pushing transition. It's long stick midfield, not long stick defense, so still working on some of my offensive game and being able to put the ball in the back of the net. Still need some work there. Didn't have any goals in college, minus an own goal one time, so 0 points in college. And yeah, but it's been a good transition. Mike Earhart, when I first came into the league, was an awesome mentor for me, kind of showing me the ropes at LSM and taking wings and all that kind of stuff. I feel like this year I've kind of, you know, fully become comfortable with the position. I'm probably more comfortable now up top than I am down low. So certainly been a transition from college, but it's been awesome so far.
And how has it felt? You just mentioned Michael Earhart. His departure meant a big role that you had to step up and fill. And we've heard, you know, great praise about how you've done it. On a leadership sort of standpoint, have you kind of taken a role in that way, sort of, you know, spreading some of your experience to some of the younger guys?
Yeah, it's a good question. You know, it's impossible to fill the shoes of Mike Earhart. I don't think there will be another Mike Earhart out there. greatest of all time, easily in my opinion, and you know, incredible both on and off the field as a leader, as you mentioned. You know, for me, I'm just kind of trying to do my role. You know, we have awesome captains at the defensive end, Jake Bernhardt and Matt Dunn, who really get us ready to play and dialed in and focused. So for me, it's, you know, really just going out there, doing my own role, playing as hard as I possibly can and leading by example, I guess. And then, you know, supporting Alex Mazzone, who's been awesome this year as well, my counterpart in any way that I can too.
Colin, thank you for joining the show and good luck in the championship.
Thanks for having me, guys. Appreciate it.